And we continue with that season now. It's the last of our essays, all part of a series of programmes marking the 200th anniversary of one of the greatest and most influential European events, Napoleon's historic retreat from Moscow in 1812. Every night this week, we've been hearing from a writer who's had, in some way or another, a personal relationship with Napoleon. Well, in Napoleon and Me tonight, Mark Adkin reflects on what Napoleon means to a military historian.
I suppose the best place to start is when I first began to show an interest in Napoleon. This was when, as a boy of about 10, I developed a fascination for soldiers and battles. Perhaps understandable for a boy who had spent the war years, the daily bombardment of news of the world at war, interspersed with air raid warnings, and on one occasion hearing bombs detonating within 200 yards of my home. I rapidly developed a passion for toy soldiers and playing mock battles on the sitting room floor. All I ever wanted for birthdays and Christmas was more toy soldiers. From this came the determination to be a professional soldier. Some stage, I forget exactly when, I read an extremely colourful and, to me, at my impressionable age, an absorbing boy's own account of the Battle of Waterloo. One thing led to another, and although my interest in military history rapidly broadened, I always retained a strong admiration for Napoleon as a brilliant leader and commander, and for what he was able to achieve because of it. In 1814, after suffering several military defeats in France, he was sent to the tiny Italian island of Elba. To a man who had recently ruled a European empire that exceeded that of the Romans, it was hardly a happy ending. As a general, he had some 50 battles, mostly victories to his credit, and his military conquests at their height rivaled those of Alexander the Great and Genghis Khan. His rule on Elba lasted just 10 months, ending with his audacious escape from the island and his desperate efforts to make a comeback against the odds. This attempt lasted just 100 days before his fate was finally sealed on the field of Waterloo by a battlefield alliance of British and Prussian armies. This was rapidly followed by his final surrender to permanent captivity on the remote British South Atlantic island of St. Helena. My interest in Napoleon and his military achievements continued when I entered the army. The short talk that I had to give as part of the selection process for admission to Sandhurst was on Napoleon and Waterloo. I concentrated on Napoleonic campaigns in my military history studies while at Sandhurst. However, my years in the army did not really leave me much time for continued serious study of Napoleon. I was just too busy, although the interest was always there. Only when I finally retired and started to write military history books was I able to come back to my original fascination. This eventually culminated in the publication of the Waterloo Companion in 2001. During my researches for this, I was able to do what I had since a boy always wanted to do, and that was visit the actual battlefield and walk the ground where Napoleon finally met his match. Well, I spent every day for a week walking the ground, armed with a large-scale map and a camera. While part of the battlefield had been altered when the huge Lion Mound was constructed in the centre of Wellington's position, incidentally you get a splendid panoramic view of the battlefield from the top, and where a main road runs through the middle, virtually all the places where the action had taken place are basically unchanged or easily recognised. I spent my days from early morning to evening exploring, taking photographs for the book, and feeling a real sense of excitement to be walking where the French Imperial Guard had made their final but futile attack, or following the route the Prussians took when they marched to launch what was arguably the most decisive attack of the battle against Napoleon's right flank. Similarly, I found the visit to the House Le Caillou, just behind the French position, where Napoleon spent the night before the battle, particularly fascinating. Overall, the visit was for me quite inspiring, and although I suppose it was strictly speaking work, was far more an enjoyable holiday. Anyway, my reward for the Waterloo Companion, apart from the sale of the book, was that I was made a member and later fellow of the International Napoleonic Society. Now let me say a few words on what for me makes Napoleon such an outstanding leader and a commander of soldiers. I am well aware that Napoleon had quite another side to his character and personality that is far from admirable, but my interest has always been in him as a military leader, who so well understood the psychology of his soldiers. He combined a brilliant grasp of strategy and what the modern military term the operational art of war, that is, manoeuvring armies in the theatre of war before any clash on the battlefield. But also he knew what made soldiers tick. It was a combination of giving them victories, rewarding them with medals. Napoleon instituted the Legion of Honour, still the top award in France today, promotion, and at times large sums of money that combined to inspire great loyalty and not, I think, to exaggerate, devotion from his men. He gave his veterans a greatly enhanced and honourable status in society. Despite being their commander-in-chief, their emperor, he was, I'm sure, considered by his veterans to be one of them. To his soldiers, the title emperor was a military rank above that of marshal, and no soldier would address him as sire, but always mon empereur. Napoleon knew the crucial importance of unit loyalty and pride in fostering esprit de corps and high morale. An important way of doing this was through the use of regimental standards, in the British Army regimental colours, that were carried into battle as rallying points. To lose them was considered a disgrace, an indelible stain on the regiment's honour. In Napoleon's army, they were gilded eagles. As an aside, one of my former regiments, the Essex Regiment, captured a French eagle at the Battle of Salamanca in the Peninsular War, and it is now still very much a prized possession of its successor regiment, the Royal Anglian Regiment. Just 17 days before Waterloo, Napoleon held a massive review in Paris, at which he presented new eagles to his assembled regiments. The review was several hours of pure theatre, and his soldiers loved it. His words were, "Soldiers of the National Guard of the Empire, soldiers of the National Land and Sea Forces, to your hands I confide the Imperial Eagle with the national colours, the French flag hanging from the staff below the eagle. Swear to defend it with the sacrifice of your blood against the enemies of France and of this throne. Swear that it will be your rallying signal." The response was immediate, a huge roar of "We swear!" Napoleon, as both a junior commander and general, has provided us with a substantial number of examples where he demonstrated physical courage. I will give just two. One at the start of his career, when at 27 he was already commanding an army campaigning in Italy. It occurred on a bridge over the River Adda at a small town of Lodi. It was here that General Bonaparte, as he then was, while under very heavy fire, personally supervised the positioning of cannons close to the bridge to support an infantry assault to capture it from the Austrians. His courage there resulted in his men giving him the nickname of Le Petit Caporal, the Little Corporal. The second example is taken from the very end of his career and occurred during his march to Paris after escaping from Elba. All along the route he had received a tumultuous welcome, in many cases by serving soldiers and veterans who decided to join him again. One of the battalions sent to halt his march and arrest him was a battalion of the 5th Regiment commanded by a Major Lansard. The battalion was drawn up astride the road running through a narrow gap between a lake and a mountain south of the village, with shouldered muskets and fixed bayonets. Napoleon rode forward at the head of the column, leading a small detachment of his Imperial Guard who had shared his banishment. He wore his instantly recognisable grey greatcoat and battered black bicorn hat. He ordered his grenadiers to reverse their arms, dismounted and walked forward to within a pistol shot of his soldiers. As he walked closer, a young officer shouted the order, "Fire!" Had anybody obeyed, that would have been the end of his comeback, and there would have been no Battle of Waterloo a few weeks later. Nobody moved. Not one soldier attempted to obey the order. Napoleon halted and unbuttoned his greatcoat and announced, "If there's any man among you who wants to kill his emperor, here I am." There was a stunned silence for a moment, and then somebody shouted, "Vive l'Empereur!" The soldiers cheered and rushed forward to touch him. Their beloved emperor was back. So how did Napoleon win this loyalty from the ordinary soldier? I will give you some examples. Firstly, at a review in 1809, he recognised a soldier who had risked his life to save his hat at the siege of Acre 9 years earlier. Napoleon demanded to know why he was still only a grenadier. The man replied he couldn't write and gestured he was something of a drunkard. His emperor gave him 50 francs. After the victory of Friedland in Prussia, he was far more generous. He rewarded his officers with both promotion and money and commissioned 146 NCOs in the field. He also gave 800,000 francs to be divided among the NCOs and men who had taken part in the campaign. After the Battle of Austerlitz, he adopted the children of all the soldiers killed in the battle. The boys would be brought up at the Imperial Palace of Rambouillet and the girls at Saint-Germain. After his death at age 51, now believed by many to have been due to slow arsenic poisoning while in exile on St. Helena, his name is perpetually revered in France. His body rests in a huge sarcophagus in the place of honour in Les Invalides in Paris. And I wonder how many tourists travelling on the metro have noticed that so many stations are named after his victories. When his death was rumoured in France, many did not believe it. One was that he had landed at Ostend. "Where are you going?" asked the wife of a Belgian veteran as he pulled on his grenadier's greatcoat. "To him," was the instant response. One of his faithful followers was a former lieutenant of the 1st Grenadiers of the Imperial Guard, the senior guard regiment named Noiseau. After retirement, he had a bronze statue of Napoleon erected at his own expense. When Noiseau died, he arranged to be buried standing up a few yards away so that he could stand guard for eternity. In 1860, the last surviving veterans received the St. Helena Medal from Napoleon's nephew, while trumpeters of the old horse chasseurs saluted with the fanfare to the Emperor at the foot of his column. I cannot finish without recounting one small, very personal way in which this great commander is remembered in a tiny village in southern France called Volon. It was here that Napoleon stopped briefly on his march to Paris after escaping from Elba. There is a delightful story here of how he stopped to address a crowd of villagers, and while doing so, one of his stirrup leathers broke. While waiting for it to be repaired, he disappeared behind a nearby wall to attend a call of nature. Today, a small stone cottage by the roadside has a plaque on the wall that reads, in the local dialect, "Ici lu Napoleon Pipi." Here Napoleon had a pee.
The essay was presented by Mark Adkin and produced in Bristol by Tim Dee. Don't forget you can listen again to all of this week's essays on the Radio 3 homepage. On Sunday, our feature continues the Napoleon theme when Andy Martin follows one of his biggest fans, the French novelist Stendhal, from Paris towards Moscow and asks if the realist novel was invented in the footsteps of the French emperor. That's this Sunday evening at 7:45 here on BBC Radio 3. Broadcasting between 90 and 93 FM on digital radio and also online. The time now is 11 o'clock. It's time for World on 3, presented this week by Lopakatari.